Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Anna today. The latest data just out this morning from the federal government shows prices continue to rise, but slowly. Inflation last month rose 0.2%, but the annual inflation rate declined to its lowest level in about 3 years. That annual inflation rate now stands at about 2.5%. That's the good news. Inflation is slowing, and it probably will lead to a cut in interest rates in the coming weeks. But we see the bad news every time we go to the grocery store to buy a loaf of bread or a box of cereal or a bag of potato chips. Grocery prices are way up from where they were 4 years ago. Groceries are 20% higher than they were at the start of the Biden administration. Republicans say Biden and his bailouts are to blame. Vice President Kamala Harris blames corporate price gouging. But as you would expect, it's not that simple. Yes, government stimulus checks have played a role, as have the quest for corporate profits. But there are many other factors: changing consumer habits, supply chain issues, the weather, wars in Ukraine and the Middle East, a lot of things. This hour, we are exploring what's up with the high grocery prices, who's to blame, if anyone is to blame. Joining us is Brian O'Rourke, professor of economics at Robert Morris University. Brian O'Rourke, welcome back to All Sides.
Hey, thanks, Mike. It's good to be here.
As we said, this is complicated. Lots of factors for the rise in grocery prices. But I'm going to ask you to rank them. If you had to rank them, what would be number one?
Maybe you can boy. So ranking them, I think at this point, probably the number one reason why grocery prices are as high as they are is that you have to pay workers a lot more now than you used to. And I wouldn't have answered it this way if you'd asked me the question 6 months ago or a year ago, because as you've said, so many things have changed over the last 3 years. But right now, what's driving those grocery prices is just labor costs. I know I've talked to people who work in the grocery industry, and they are still having so much trouble filling openings in their operations, and when they do fill those openings, they're paying workers sometimes 100% more than what they were paying them at the beginning of the pandemic.
Wow, that's great news for the workers, you know, who are probably, you could argue, underpaid in the before times.
Absolutely. I mean, you're talking about a segment of the workforce who was really close to making minimum wage. Maybe they were just making a little bit above that. So, you know, that's kind of a great windfall for those workers, but those costs end up getting passed on to everybody else.
Yeah. And then, of course, we can get into the data, but the rise in wages, not only for grocery store workers and food processing workers, the increases in wages have not kept up, at least in the peak years of inflation, did not keep up with the rate of inflation. But so let's start with this. Also, the grocery and the inflation rates spiked right after the pandemic. In the waning days of the pandemic, as we were coming out of it and getting back to our, quote, normal lives, would this have happened without the pandemic? Would we have seen this inflation rate? Would we have seen the rise in grocery prices without COVID-19?
No, that's an easy question. Thank you. You know, that COVID screwed up so much of what we are used to seeing in the economy. I was talking to a couple of colleagues last night. We were doing a sort of a live response to the debate. And this is one of the things that we kept coming back to, that as political candidates talk about, are you better now than you were 4 years ago? The answer is almost universally yes, because 4 years ago you're comparing what was sort of the middle of this COVID madness. You can't help but be better off. So I mean, when we look back at that data, you know, in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years from now, we're going to see that period of time was such an outlier, and it changed a lot of the ways that we're used to behaving within the economy.
So let's start with what we did during the pandemic. We did not eat out at restaurants. But we still had to eat. Mm-hmm. So we went to the grocery store. what role did that play, increasing demand at your local Kroger's or Giant Eagle here in Central Ohio?
Yeah, so this gets back to your first question. You know, what's the number one reason that we see this increase in food prices? And you know, during that pandemic, there are all these limitations on the ability to do business, and we kind of added on top of that all of the government programs that helps people who are out of work. We gave, you know, the government gave people a lot of money. And so when you combine those two things, you know, increased means to spend and decreasing supplies on the shelves, you just create this perfect scenario where you're going to see higher prices. And that, I think, during that time period, it was, if we wouldn't have seen prices go up, economists would have gone absolutely crazy. It would have violated everything that we understand about the way markets work.
Yeah. It wasn't just prices at the grocery store. Restaurant prices went up as well when the restaurants did start to reopen. I mean, you were paying $2 or $3 more for even a basic entree at sort of a family style restaurant.
Right. And if you look at prices at fast food restaurants as well, those prices were just sky high.
If we could go back before, to the before times, and mm-hmm. say the 10 years leading up to 2020 and the pandemic, it seemed like inflation was just not an issue. Interest rates were just so low. The Fed was not worried about raising interest rates to cool the economy. Was inflation, especially food prices, were they abnormally low during, say, the decade before the spike in early 21 or so, 22?
That's a fantastic question. This is something else that I've been talking with some folks in econ circles about. And most of us have kind of reached the conclusion that that really, really low period of inflation, that might be the outlier. So we look back, if we look back over a much longer period of time, we're going to see that we have record low inflation and record low interest rates. And like so many things in economics, there are ups and there are downs, and sometimes the downs are good for us. So when we have low inflation, when we have low interest rates, that's a great situation to find yourself in. But it, you can get lulled into the belief that this is the new normal when actually you're living in a period of abnormality in terms of inflation and interest rates. So a lot of us think that we're going to look back, you know, people who do research in macroeconomics will look back at this period of time and wonder what was going on there because it's so unusual. And yeah, that makes that higher inflation that we've experienced more recently that much more potent and that much more, it affects us so much more because we're not used to it.
Yeah. And it not only did inflation come back, it came back with a vengeance. I mean, it just was like, whoa, look at that. You know, the eggs is the classic example of how right. Eggs just all of a sudden jumped. But that goes to another issue, and that is, you mentioned the cost of labor in food processing plants and grocery stores, but there was supply chain issues there as well. And that during the pandemic, that also fueled some of this increase, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Supply chains were, they were just a mess. I mean, we've got, you can't process food because everything is shut down. I mean, even when we had essential workers kind of, that idea of establishing essential workers in food processing was an important step to keep things from getting even worse. But you add on to that a lot of things such as, you know, droughts. You have problems with in the cattle industry, for example, farmers just can't afford to feed and water their animals. We're at a point now in the beef industry where supplies are lower than they have been at any time since the 1950s. So as you reduce the supply of where the food comes from, that's going to keep prices high, and so that gets, you know, we have that happening. We have I love orange juice. And one of the worst things that I hear about are problems with citrus crops in Florida. And they've had some big problems with citrus crops. And so that causes prices to go up. And you add on to the other supply chain problems, whether it's just shipping, whether it's shipping products from one place to another, whether it's finding enough workers in the grocery store, then that keeps food from getting onto the shelves. There's a lot of supply chain problems that are exacerbated by COVID, and it just that just adds up over time.
And then at the tail end of the Trump administration, there was a stimulus package. Money got flowed into the economy to help people who had lost their jobs, who had lost a source of income. A ton of money went into the economy. That continued when President Biden took office in early 21. There was a lot. Was there too much money sloshing around in the economy?
Oh yeah, so a guy named Milton Friedman years and years ago, he's a great economist, won the Nobel Prize, was really famous for his research into money and the influence of money on inflation. So his mantra really that's been taken up by economists since is that inflation is always a monetary phenomenon, that you're going to have inflation if you print too much money. And we see when you see the increase in available funds to households, you can understand why there was inflation. Now, that was a conscious policy choice to try to, because people were scared and they didn't really know what to do and how to react to the pandemic, and they didn't want a collapse of the economy. So the policymakers make this recommendation. They say, hey, we need to get money into the hands of people so they can spend it. And so that's the policy choice, but you always have consequences with policies. And one of those consequences was at least a contributing factor to making inflation worse than it would have otherwise been.
Yeah. And we never get it exactly right in the moment.
Absolutely
Hindsight is
not.
always 2020. We saw after the housing crisis and the recession of 2008, 2009, it took too long to recover. This one here, we went too far the other way because we didn't want it to
Right. And
collapse.
yeah, and when I mean, it's easy to look at these things with the perspective of say, well, we already knew what happened. We know what the outcome is. That means that people who are in those policy positions, if they get it wrong, they're going to have a lot more blame heaped upon them than they deserve. And of course, if they get it right, or at least if they get it less wrong, then they're going to receive a lot more of the glory than they deserve as well. There's a huge sort of luck factor in macro policy.
Yeah. We're talking with Brian O'Rourke. He's a professor of economics at Robert Morris University. We're talking about the why we are paying more at the grocery store. Prices have cooled a bit. They're only up 0.1% last month, according to the stats out today, but they are 20% higher than they were 4 years ago. Bloomberg reports that a top Kroger executive testified in an antitrust court hearing that Kroger increased the price of milk and eggs higher than its added cost. Bloomberg obtained an email. Andy Groff, who is the senior director for pricing at Kroger, said, quote, "On milk and eggs, retail inflation has been significantly higher than cost inflation." Did stores like Kroger and other, I don't want to pick on Kroger, but other grocery stores or chains around the country, did they use this to say, we've had low prices for this 10 years. Let's use this to increase our profits a bit.
That's a tough one. I mean, I think the answer is probably yes. But if you look at profit margins in the grocery store chain, profit margins have gone up a little bit, but they haven't gone up excessively. I because we're dealing with food, it's certainly an emotional issue. Everybody has to buy food, and nobody likes going to the store and seeing food prices go up. But in particular with eggs and a few other staples there in the grocery store, there are a lot of other factors going into those prices going up. It's not, if there is sort of that corporate greed angle, the percentage of the price increase due that is attributable to corporate greed is really, really small.
So you don't agree with Kamala Harris, who says there was gouging, price gouging?
No, not at all. No, I mean, I think it's an easy statement to make. It's certainly something that probably resounds with people from a political perspective. My guess is that her economic advisors would say that you want to maybe slow the roll on that claim somewhat. That being said, the grocery store industry has this reputation recently. I remember growing up and we had four or five different places you could buy food, and now we're down to two. There has been a lot of concentration in the grocery store industry. If you think about Kroger, you mentioned Kroger and that proposed merger with Albertsons in terms of this making a much larger grocery store chain. But you also have to consider how whether they're able to compete with a behemoth like Walmart. Amazon's in the
Amazon,
grocery business these days, and for a smaller chain to be able to compete with those big players, they need to have the same advantages in terms of buying power. So, combined Albertsons and Kroger is going to have they're going to be able to compete with Walmart better on price than your local grocery store. That's one of the reasons why the small mom and pop stores go out of business. They can't compete on
Yeah,
price.
they've got to f either find a niche or something like that to stay relevant. Brian O'Rourke is a professor of economics at Robert Morris University. Professor O'Rourke, thanks very much for joining us on All Sides.
Hey, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks a lot.
When we come back, we'll look at the political implications of this. The person in office always gets the blame for rising inflation. Do they deserve it? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
This is All Sides with Anna Staver on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Anna today. This hour, we're talking about the higher prices for groceries that we've seen over the past 4 years. Across the aisle, there has been universal recognition that prices at the grocery store are higher and higher than they were at the start of the Biden administration, those sort of the beginning days of the end of the pandemic. What is not universal is what people blame for the high prices. And joining me now is Joel Griffith, a research fellow in the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Joel, welcome to All Sides.
Hello.
Hey, Joel, good to see you. Thanks for joining us here on All Sides with Anna Staver. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Anna today. I asked our last guest, an economist, to rank the many factors that lead to higher grocery prices, lead to inflation. What would you rank as the number one reason why grocery prices are about 20% higher than they were in 2021?
Yeah, it's a real impact on American families. Certainly, energy costs have been a factor in this, both the transportation in general. A lot of our groceries, of course, are imported, and shipping costs in some areas have risen, but also transportation costs coast to coast, along with the energy inputs on the farms. But agriculture, especially in the processing side, is also a labor intensive industry. So just as businesses across the country have had to deal with rising labor costs, labor costs are another big factor as to why our prices overall have been rising. And then, of course, there are the shorter term drastic fluctuations in things such as orange juice or cocoa, for instance. And those are more related to either short term changes in climate or in the cases of coffee. A lot of that can be geopolitical as well. So that would be my ranking in terms of the three primary drivers of food inflation over the past few years.
So energy, labor, and just changing situation. I always think of the movie Trading Places when they're waiting for the orange juice report. Whenever somebody mentions orange juice prices, I just have that scene in my mind.
It almost made me want to be a professional futures trader at one time. I'm not kidding you on that.
We're dating ourselves with the Dan Aykroyd, Eddie Murphy movie back from the 80s, I believe. So how about, we talked about inflation was so low for so long. Were we spoiled for the 10 years leading up to 2020 when prices were rising at, we were talking about deflation. We were worried about deflation for a little while. Did we just get spoiled?
You're right. For many years, we got very used to around a 2% annual inflation rate. Some years that were actually somewhat lower than that. But what we saw a few years ago, when we had the initial shutdowns with the pandemic, and then we began to prime the economic pump with a lot of money printing at the Federal Reserve, a number of economists, and including myself, we warned that there would be future inflationary impacts from that. So you're very right. We got used to this long period of relatively stable growth in the prices of things. But what we saw really starting at the late 2020 into 2021 and 2022 was the biggest increase in federal spending relative to the economy that we've seen since World War II. And much of that was financed by the Federal Reserve. And look, food prices weren't exempt from that. I'm not saying the entire increase in food prices were because of that money printing, but the grocery market was not left unscathed. Neither were your home prices nor your automobile prices. So there are consequences from that reckless spending and printing. And to be fair, that wasn't just the current administration. That was the prior administration as well that embarked on a lot of these expansionary government spending programs.
You know, hindsight's always 20/20. And I mentioned to our last guest that, we probably didn't get it right. We never get it right. Never get it exactly right, no matter what the crisis is. Were there warning signs that perhaps, especially the second influx of money after Joe Biden took office, that maybe that was a bit too much?
Oh, absolutely. And when you think of this in terms of basic economics, when you look at the price of a good or service, it's very reliant on supply and demand. And if you look at, I guess to clarify with that, of course, if you have increased supply, all things else being equal, the price will drop. Likewise with demand, if you have an increase in demand, it's going to, with limited supply, it's going to increase the price. So there's an equilibrium. But what we saw during this, the COVID shutdown, then the years that followed, we saw initially, of course, a diminishment of both supply and demand with the shutdowns. But then as the economy reopened, we saw an increase in demand, both in terms of people being able to go back out shopping, but also because of the enormous amounts of stimulus that were flowing in, both in terms of stimulus checks, but also juicing the banking system. So we went ahead and we're still having a reduction in supply, but yet we were superloading on demand. The result of that was predictable, a rise in inflation. And that's what we've seen now perpetuated over the last few years. We've seen that monetary supply increase at a rate that is faster than the real growth in goods and services produced in the economy.
We're talking with Joel Griffith. He's a research fellow at the Thomas Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. We're talking about rising grocery prices here on All Sides with Anna Staver. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Anna today. According to a report from the FTC released in March, food and beverage retailers saw their revenues outpace costs by 7% last year, a record high. What role does corporate profits and the seeking of corporate profits and perhaps making up for those lean years of low price increases play in this situation?
Yeah, I think it's very important to not cherry pick any one quarter, any one year. What I want to look at are the trends. And I've done a lot of that. You've probably seen some of the past work and work that others have done as well, looking at profit margins, both in the food production space. We're not talking about the farms here. We're talking about the processors as well, but also the retailers. And what you see now over the past several years is we actually have seen a margin compression in the food space, both on the processor side and the retail side. And overall, profit margins in that grocery space are right around 1.5%, basically $1.50 on every $100 worth of goods sold. It's actually now that profit margin is somewhat less than it was prior to the pandemic. Kroger, of course, is probably the one of the most well-known retailers, especially in my home state of Ohio. If you look at their profit margins, they're not just less than where they were prior to the pandemic. They're roughly about half of where those margins were a few decades ago. So it's been a long-term trajectory down in profit margin squeezes. And if you look at the world's largest meat processor, Tyson Foods, in the most recent financial reports, they've actually seen a net negative operating margin. So overall, the bottom line here are that food price the food the cost to produce the food and sell the food, those costs have actually been rising than the cost to the consumer, suggesting that businesses have actually been absorbing some of this inflationary impact.
How about, there's the rising cost of a box of cereal. And then if you look at the fine print of the number of ounces of Cheerios in that box, that's gone down. It's, shrinkflation. How big of a is that just perception or is it real?
Oh, this is a very real. I don't think any of us are imagining this. I have a few vices. One of them is actually a cereal. This happened the other night. I was at
I've always
CVS.
complained about cereal. It's bread in a box. They shouldn't charge that much, but that's okay.
I was at CVS looking up for a box of Fruit Loops, and I saw, wow, $2.99. And then I noticed, yeah, that box is no longer that 16 ounce. I think it was a 10 or 11 ounce box. So, yeah, shrinkflation is a real thing. This isn't fraudulent, of course. The amount per ounce is very clearly, or per unit is clearly on that label. But yeah, in this era of higher costs, for some people, that food budget, it's a big part of their annual their monthly budget. I mean, my budget as a single guy is $600 a month just on groceries. It's a growing part of my budget. It's a growing part of those who are middle class and lower middle class, especially. And so for them, it's not just a matter of trying to fool the consumer into thinking prices are lower. For some people, it's a matter of just being able to afford those basic necessities and buying, sadly, in smaller quantities.
One of the tools we had as shoppers, if we didn't want to buy the brand name, say box of cereal, we could buy the generic brand, the store brand. And it seems like it, when I go to the grocery store, I see fewer and fewer of those store brand options. Is that because of the supply chain issue, or is it what's going on there? Why are there? Am I, maybe it's just, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's just as many store brand boxes of cereal or coffee as there was before.
I think it's twofold on the store brands. Number one, it's these margins are just they're really not that wide. When you look at the national brands, they have the economies of scale when it comes to producing that. So when you're producing a box of Cheerios at your General Mills, that's not just going to the Krogers, that's going to Krogerson's and Albertsons and Dollar Generals. It's huge economies of scale. The margins just aren't that wide on that. Second of all, when it comes to cereal or even toothpaste for that matter, there's a lot of consumer loyalty to that product itself. And once again, as a I didn't realize I'm talking about cereal so much, but as a huge fan of cereal, I'll tell you what, I have tried to experiment with between Kellogg's Corn Flakes and the off-brand, or Frosted Mini, which I absolutely love, and the store off-brand. And maybe it is just imagined. But I'll tell you what, for me, I go ahead and spend that extra dollar or two on what I grew up with as a child.
I don't know how the generic brands work. Is it a capacity issue that because of cost of labor that these places like General Mills, they don't have any extra capacity to serve the off brands?
Yeah, honestly, I'm not that big of an expert on the
Yeah.
off brand versus the private label,
Yeah.
if you will. But yeah, my educated guess, conjecture would be, yeah, it is, it's more of an economies of scale issue.
Let's get to the politics of it. It came up in last night's debate, probably not as often as President Trump would have liked it to come up, but perhaps that was his fault. Anyway, Biden takes a lot of blame from voters for the rising cost of groceries. How much credit, blame should those people in office get for inflation rates and rising costs?
Yeah, I think we have to look at the big picture here. We know that one of the primary drivers of inflation in terms of across the board price increases, it's a monetary phenomenon. And we know that our central bank controls the money supply, and that over the past few years, that central bank has worked hand in hand with our Congress and with the White House to fund government expenditures. Those government expenditures began rising dramatically at the very end of the Trump administration, with bipartisan, lopsidedly passed spending bills that were signed into law. That was the initial spark of this inflationary bomb that we've seen. But we know that in the current administration, we saw successive spending measures, even as the economy reopened, that further fueled this inflationary boom. So I think there's a lot of blame to go around with both political parties that approved the initial rounds of spending, and then with these successive rounds. That's a partial answer. But second of all, we have to look too at these other inputs that are driving up costs, namely on the labor side and also on the energy side. There is a contrast, some of it which was marred last night, maybe not as vividly drawn out, but between the policies of the two candidates that are running. Look, labor policy is very important. If you look at some of the port issues happening both on the East Coast but also in California, those are going to have real consequences as far as are we going to be able to automate these ports. These are true policy considerations that are going to impact what it costs for us to actually get the goods, including the food that we're receiving. And then on the energy front, agriculture is, as we said a second ago, a very energy intensive industry. And if we embark on a mission to actually deprive our manufacturers of what they need in terms of energy to produce, that will have long-term implications on the costs of food.
Just one more question, and I'll make it an easy one. Why don't prices go down? Because I don't think we're going to see, prices. I don't think in 4 years, I don't think grocery prices are going to be 20% less than they are now.
It's unlikely that prices across the board are going to be lower 4 years from now. To be across the board lower across the economy, that would require either really a massive
depression. We don't want that.
Collapse, exactly. Yeah. Or or a massive contraction in the money supply. There's no appetite to massively contract the money supply, and I would not recommend that either, of course. Yeah. I mean, if you have massive deflation, that means if you are in debt, then the repayment costs are going to rise dramatically in real terms. So I don't think anyone, maybe except a few lenders, would want that. We're not going to see a big shrinking of the money supply. We're not going to see prices going in reverse. On specific products, though, especially in the food sector, you may see prices come back down. In fact, if you're heavy on eggs in your diet, or even meat, you probably noticed that in a recent month, those prices have come.
Yes, they have. Yep.
Lower, especially with eggs. Same thing with and I want to mention that those markets, eggs and meat. Number one, on the meat side, we know that that's especially susceptible to things like disease or drought, natural calamity. And that's why you will see very sometimes dramatic swings in the cost of meat.
Yeah, we saw that with the bird flu epidemic. That they had to wipe out farms and farms of chickens.
And I want to say thanks to our free market, you're able to see farms very rapidly respond to that. If you have a mass wipeout of your poultry, or in some parts of the world, you're able to respond relatively quickly to getting your own what is the agriculture term here? Your own supply of
Yeah.
chickens dramatically increase. Things like oranges, though, of course, are a little bit different. You'll see those be very susceptible to freezes, for instance, but it's harder to ramp up supply with a thing like oranges because it takes, of course, years to cultivate that tree.
Our thanks to Joel Griffith, research fellow at the Thomas Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation, and also a big fan of Fruit Loops and frosted mini wheats, we learned today. Thanks, Joel. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Our conversation on rising grocery prices continues when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
This is All Sides with Anna Staver on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Anna today. This hour, we're looking at why groceries cost so much. Why have the prices of groceries increased by about 20% since 2021? This segment, we're going to look at some corporate news. The proposed merger between Cincinnati-based Kroger and Albertsons could be the largest such merger in U.S. history. It also raises concerns that it could result in higher food prices. Joining us now to talk about the possible impact of this merger to our wallets is Christine Pettigo-Bartholomew. She's a professor of law at the State University of New York at Buffalo School of Law. Her research focuses on the intersection between antitrust enforcement and consumer protection. Christine, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me.
The you know, it's sort of got, there's a lot going on these days, but the Kroger-Albertson merger has sort of fallen perhaps a bit below the radar. Where does it stand right now?
So right now, it's actually a pretty hot moment in this issue. There's currently a preliminary injunction hearing happening, and I know that just sounds like procedural mucky stuff, but what it really does is matter if the judge is going to block the pending merger and allow the FTC to have its trial on the merger, which is currently scheduled for October 1st. It sounds like procedure, but when we think about these injunctions, injunction decisions often decide whether or not the merger will be even pursued. As I have read, Kroger and Albertson said, if the preliminary injunction is granted, they will be abandoning this merger.
Interesting.
So we should have an answer as to what's going to happen real soon.
In the next week or so, I mean, October 1st is right around the corner.
I mean, I'm thinking so. Initially, the preliminary injunction hearing was supposed to conclude Friday. It just got extended for some additional witnesses. So I do think we're going to hear quite soon.
Did Kroger and Albertsons anticipate this much resistance? I mean, many mergers face, you know, pushback from regulators. Did they anticipate this much pushback?
I don't know. And it seems the reason I'm particularly perplexed is when they initially announced this merger, the details in terms of the divestiture, which really is going to be the focus of whether the merger gets approved, were pretty thin. And then over time, it seems like they became increasingly aware that this was not going to be an easy approval process. And then the scope of the divestiture starts increasing and increasing. So I can't say for sure what was going on in their minds initially. But given the climate and given the size of this deal, I really should have anticipated that this was going to be reviewed quite closely.
I'm just guessing, but the fact that grocery prices have increased by 20% in the past 3 years is not helping their case that there should be fewer options for shoppers if these stores merge.
I don't think it's helping them. Of course, pricing is complicated, right? So you have so many points in the chain of distribution, and then any adjustment in one part necessarily has downstream consequences. But there's additional information here that's not particularly helping. The prices at these groceries increase faster than the rate of inflation. So just turning and saying inflation or supplier side issues doesn't really explain the pricing here. And I think that that combination of profit margins being pretty high when prices are already high suggests that these companies were passing on many or more of their costs to consumers. Other grocery chains weren't doing that same thing. So of course, these regulators are going to be looking really closely and say, explain your pricing practices and tell me how this doesn't mean you already have too much power.
Now, our previous guests, they pointed to Kroger in particular, saying that their profit margins really have not increased that much because of rising energy costs, rising labor costs. Can you explain the rising prices on those two factors, energy and labor?
Sure, they are right. Both of those did go up, and both of those do impact pricing. My concern has been there has been testimony offered by Kroger executives that even with that, prices exceeded the growth in those components. And so you start being able to wonder from an economic standpoint, if the market's operating correctly, if you have enough competitive forces at play, the margin above costs should be very minimal. We were seeing at Kroger's in particular, the margins above even those increased costs still quite high. And that tends to be indicative of market power, meaning that there just aren't the types of competitive forces we want in play helping drive down prices for consumers.
Yeah, we mentioned it earlier in the hour, but this was from Bloomberg. The top Kroger executive testified in an antitrust court hearing that Kroger increased the price of milk and eggs higher than its added cost. The gentleman named Andy Groff, director of pricing, said on milk and eggs in particular, retail inflation has been significantly higher than cost inflation. So at least at that point in time, those two items, the costs were not as high as what they were charging.
Correct, correct. And I mean, that matters because virtually every family is buying milk and eggs. Those are really core items. I do know that there has been more complicated analysis as far as what's happening with processed food. Those input prices have gone up. But for milk and eggs, those are the things that caught my attention. Those are weekly purchases, at least at our house, even more than weekly purchases. So increased profit margins on those are the type of evidence that the FTC is really going to go after to say, why should we allow these companies more market power?
Now, the companies argue, and they point to Walmart. Walmart has 27% of the supermarket industry. And they say to compete with that, and then Amazon and other retailers continuing to grow, we need those economies of scale. We need to merge. How do you respond to that?
I don't know what to do with that statement because if that was the test, then every merger should always be approved, right? Lots of industries compete with Walmart and Amazon. That's not what the test is. It's not a question of do you need this to compete? At that point, what we expect from an antitrust framework is fine. If you need to compete, do so by differentiating your product, do so on price, do so on output. But just pointing to a larger competitor is not enough to justify a merger.
You mentioned the divestiture. Albertsons did this once before when it merged with Safeway. What can we take from that? What lessons did Albertsons learn from that, did Kroger and Albertsons learn from that could help them in this case?
In my view, we should be very skeptical of the divestiture given what happened before. In the past merger with Albertsons and Safeway, they divested some companies to a company called Haggen's, and they divested stores that were, some say, set up to fail. So what ended up happening at the end of the day, those Haggen stores got repurchased by Albertsons. And it's the last thing you want from an antitrust standpoint. If the divestitures, we do these divestitures because we want to ensure that if there is a merger, there's still competition. If Albertsons was able to reacquire them cheaper, the divestiture only helps them. So hopefully, we learn from history and we take a look at the current divestiture with an extra degree of skepticism given those past events. C&S is not Haggen's, I get that. But if I, as I've been following the news, one of the senior vice presidents from C&S said that the stores that they were going to receive as part of the divestiture were some of the worst stores. So, how likely those stores are to really provide an alternative competition source, It's something I think we really should be looking at cautiously.
That leads to the whole issue of food deserts. And, you know, if there's a merger, do you anticipate lower performing stores, if Albertsons and Kroger merge, to be closed? And you have to figure that those lower performing stores are going to be in lower income rural areas, lower income urban areas.
I mean, I think you're right to connect all those dots the way that you suggest. And there is a real fear here about what this is going to mean for food deserts.
What role do the dollar stores play in this? Because that has grown. I mean,
Right.
where do they fall into this ecosystem? Because they have, in some cases, filled those food deserts, but they've also hurt local stores when they move into town.
So they're interesting because whether or not you want to include them in the market definition for these grocery stores depends, look, on some of the economic definitions for markets. But I do think we have to be pretty aware that when you do have a Dollar General or when you have a dollar store that's offering food items, you're not getting the same degree of choice and variety that you would if there was a more vibrant competition for perhaps lower store, lower price grocery stores. The selection just is much less. And there becomes a barrier in some ways as those dollar stores take root in certain communities from mom and pop grocery stores or other local stores entering to therefore provide some type of competitive benefits to consumers living in those communities.
Is there the opportunity there that if dollar stores were to offer better produce, better quality food, that they could make even more of an inroads and help solve some of this food desert problem?
I think that they could help mitigate. I don't think by themselves they would solve it. Because at the same point, then you have one store. So that doesn't get me the type of competition I think you really need for prices and output, which are like really what we think about for antitrust. How much variety do you get? How much choice do you get? And at what price? I would need to have more than one store in an area to make sure that the quality on those key variables is there.
Now, the grocery stores are at the end of the sort of, to pardon the pun, at the end of the food chain here. There's been a
Well,
lot
you and I are really at the end of the food chain, but that's
of that's
okay.
true. As far as the retail and the sales process, there's been consolidation on the food processing side, and that doesn't we don't see those. We don't see with the Tyson factory unless we live next door to them or we live down the street from them. But we see our Kroger, we see our Albertsons, we see our Dollar General and Giant Eagle every day when we drive by or we go to the grocery store. Are we forgetting that and those consolidations and how what impact they're having on not only the consumer but the grocery stores themselves and their ability to make a profit?
Sure, of course. I mean, whenever you have concentration at anywhere in a distribution chain, there's going to be downstream consequences, potential, right? Not always, but potentially. And my concerns in terms of concentration here are not limited to the grocery store level. We do need to be assuring that anywhere in a food distribution chain, if we are sincerely worried about prices for groceries, that we're looking at what's happening at every step.
What about we talked about the dollar stores, sort of in the lower price point, different type of shopper goes there. What about the higher end, you know, the boutique grocery stores? We have them here in Central Ohio. Smaller stores, smaller chains, higher end products. Every city has them. I mean, Whole Foods is the big chain, and of course that's associated with Amazon now. But what role do they play in all this? Do they offer choice at all?
Not at a large enough percentage for their market for me of course, they're going to be part of the relevant market definition. However, they don't really offer the type of check you're talking about on price because what they've done is differentiate themselves oftentimes on either variety or quality or another variable. So they don't provide the check I think we need if you're talking about general mainstream mid socioeconomic families trying to figure out whether or not their grocery bills are going to go up.
So, if you were to have a crystal ball, do you see this Kroger and Albertson merger going through from the tea leaves that you're reading?
Oh, it's so hard. I know better than to predict. I can say I really hope it does not. I have grave reservations about the consequences of this merger, having seen what happened with the prior merger. And the more I'm beginning to learn about the divestiture, I just don't have the confidence that this is any good for consumers. Now, that said, I've done antitrust for a long time, and I know that questions for antitrust are difficult and complicated. And even when the nuances seem clear to me, a judge might have a different view. The reason I don't think this is going to go through is once the preliminary injunction, if it were granted, I think the deal has to go away simply because the companies have already spent $800 million on attorney's fees.
Wow.
And at some point, they're going to have to stop the bleeding. And I think that that's why they're inclined to say it would just cost too much to pursue.
But
That's just my guess.
say this one doesn't succeed, there'll be others, right? Kroger will find perhaps another partner. Albertsons will find another partner. Giant Eagle or the other stores around the, Winn-Dixie or whatever,
Oh, sure. And Mike, we're going to end up talking again about a grocery merger. I promise you that. As much as I don't like to predict, that is true. There will be another merger that will be analyzed. It's just a question of what. But remember that merger analysis, we really have to be looking at a specific point in time. Who knows what might be the variables at play then or who the other competitive forces are. But yes, there will be other mergers to be talking about at some future point.
Christine Pedego Bartholomew, Professor of Law at the State University of New York at Buffalo, an antitrust expert. Thanks for joining us on All Sides.
Thank you.
Grocery prices are going to stay high. Maybe they'll level off a bit, but at least maybe we'll get used to them over the next couple of years, and they won't go up anymore. This has been All Sides with Anna Staver on 89.7 NPR News.